Welcome back to Shattering Myths. As we do in our concluding hour, we're going to return to the Torah. There is no better place for us to understand the guidance that God has provided us. There's no better way for us to come to know Him. There's no better place to look for His instructions as to how we can participate in His covenant. And that is important because salvation is only afforded to the covenant's children. If you are not part of God's covenant family, you are not saved. Now, this is the line that we were considering at the end of our program yesterday. It is an essential insight in a number of areas. The last of the insights, though, is the one that I want to continue to address today, because it's not processing this information is what has led so many to the erroneous conclusion that the God of the Old Testament, in their parlance, is vicious, that He is wrathful. And that is just not the case. He is actually extraordinarily loving, and it is His desire to protect His children that is the basis for His instructions. So here was the line that we considered, yesterday. It is from Bereshit in the beginning, Genesis 15:16. That happens to be the first of the Torah's books. And they shall return. He's speaking of the children of Yisrael. He's speaking of the children of the covenant. Here, he's speaking now of Yisrael in the fourth generation of time. Tells us that a generation is 100 years because he's already specified this as being 400 years. Because indeed the distortion, perversity, and depravity of the Emory. That is a Hebrew word that means those who pontificate evil. Immoral soothsayers and wicked wordsmiths. It is typically transliterated Amorites, which would be from Amar, which means to speak. Is not yet fully finished. Are totally complete. So those who speak evil, those who promote evil, he's talking here about religious clerics and the political types. He says they're in league with demonic influences. They are pontificating evil, but yet their corruption, their distortion, their depravity, but particularly their perversion of His testimony, is not yet finished. Nor totally complete. So it's a very important insight and understanding. The second portion, the conclusion of this passage, is essential to knowing why Yahweh endorsed the annihilation of a handful of Amorite towns at the conclusion of the Exodus. It would be, Larry, and I think you're back with us here.
Mm-hmm.
It would be like if you can put yourself in God's shoes for a moment, and you are witnessing human events circa the late 1920s and early 1930s, and as witnessing those events, you notice that there's a group of people who are stunningly corrupt that are emerging in Germany under the banner of Nazis. And you recognize, because you can see the future, that these individuals are going to sway their fellow countrymen to join them, to empower them. And then from that base, they're going to start a series of wars that are going to coalesce and sweep across the globe, and that these attacks are going to lead to the deaths of 55 million people. If you're God and you know exactly who they are and what they're going to do, would you kill them to spare the lives of 55 million people?
Yes. Yes, yeah. I would.
Yeah.
Now, I know why Yahweh didn't do it.
Why didn't God do it? Because he obviously knew who those individuals were, and he might have been able to kill 5,000 people that were unworthy of life to spare the lives of 55 million. Why didn't God do it?
Because he doesn't interfere in the operations of what people do. There's free will.
Except with one exception. There is an exception where God does intervene, where he does interfere. And that's in the lives of his covenant children. He, as all fathers, will engage to protect the well-being of his family. But apart from that, he won't. And now you can say, well, by the fact that he did not intervene and kill those 5,000 Nazis, and along with them maybe the 5,000 communists in China that led to the deaths of 40 million Chinese, and he didn't kill the ruling military leaders and the royal family in Japan that led to the deaths and carnage and savagery of so many. Why didn't he do so, particularly recognizing that 6 million Jews were slaughtered as a result of him not doing so?
And because they're in a situation where the covenant is not renewed, and they're in a divorce decree at this point under Hosea. That's the way it is. They're on their own.
Yeah, they violated the terms of the agreement, and therefore they were in fact on their own. And as a result of being on their own, they were not part of his family at this time. At that time, in fact, at this time even. The vast preponderance of Yehudim, of Israelites, are not part of his covenant family. And so he did not intervene to protect them. But in this particular case that he's talking about here in Israel, an entirely different story. There, he was actively engaged in their lives and did intervene to protect them. And your point is valid, God has made free will an extraordinarily important part of the human experience. And he did so because without free will, there is no purpose for life or the universe to exist. We exist.
Well, it's the same, you know, it goes right back to Yahweh's not a religious deity. He wants to be chosen. He doesn't want to force submission.
Right.
When, you know, I mean, flat out, Abraham asked, could submission be a part of the covenant? And he said, no. The Ishmael means submission. Laughter could be, you know,
right.
Yitzhak, but
right.
Not submission. It can't be a part of the covenant.
Right.
And therefore, you know, he's got a handout. Of course, I always think of his name. I'm
yeah.
sure you
and
do.
By the way, Ishmael also was a product of slavery because it was Hagar, a Egyptian slave. And second
right.
of all, Ishmael was not the product of a marriage. And the covenant, the word for covenant in Hebrew, berith, and the word for marriage in Hebrew are the same. And so there were
family as well.
Right. So, yeah, beith is the Hebrew word for family, which is the basis of berith. So family and home. So you are correct. God does not intervene in the affairs of the vast preponderance of people. So he did not intervene in killing the maybe 15,000 people between Imperial Japan, Communist China, maybe 20,000, Soviet Russia, and Nazi Germany that would have collectively spared the world 100 million lives.
20 million in Russia, yeah.
Yeah, but collectively, 100 million people died died as a result of not foreshortening the lives of the communists in Russia, the Nazis in Germany, the communists in China, and the imperialists in Japan. But in this particular case, free will was the issue, and he doesn't intervene so as not to preclude free will. Otherwise, life is a joke. It's nothing but something that is orchestrated, where we have manipulated and have no say. So it is extremely important that God not intervene unless he has to protect his children. In the case of the Emory or Amorites in the Promised Land in his home, what he was saying is that, you know, these people are corrupt, but they aren't totally corrupt. There are some of them that have a chance. And what he's saying is that recognizing that they're not totally corrupt at this point, there is would be unjust for me to exterminate them. But I know that my children are going to have be enslaved in Egypt for 400 years. When they come out of Egypt, the corruption, the perversity of the Amorites, the people living in these towns in the Promised Land, it will have reached the point where it is complete. It is beyond hope. There is no way to remedy the problem. And when that occurs, eliminating them is just. It's merciful. It's God doing the right thing to protect his children, just as it would be appropriate to exterminate bubonic plague-infested rats in a home before you move in your family.
Yeah, well, you know, and people don't want to see this because they don't want to. Look, I had a debate yesterday where I was debating a Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
There was a girl that joined our group, and she's been with us and her husband now for quite some time, and they've just been catching hell from the Mormons. And a guy got on there, and he started, and you know, I said, you know, he wanted to get into my personality, and then how kind he was, and how big his heart was, and I said, this is what I found with religious individuals, is that they're interested in talking about how kind they are, how big their heart is. They'll talk about divergent plans other than Yahweh's. They'll even talk about their opinions. But what they won't do is seriously consider his words, which is, after all, what he asks us to do. See, and so that's the problem we're in, isn't it? I mean, really, that's a big, big part of the problem. Everybody wants to do everything other than what Yahweh asked or you know.
That's right.
We do.
And also, just to view this from God's point of view, if God is telling us that people will be so corrupt that there is no hope for them, there's no saving them, there's no reasoning with them, there's no negotiating with them, and that they are a menace to the world. Since he created life, since he knows exactly what behavior is going to be manifest in the future, ought we not respect his presentation, his perspective, and not argue with it? We'll be back with Shattering Myths. We have Jaime back on the line, calling back in from Colombia, who I think has more questions. And we'll continue with the testimony of Yahweh and consider what he had to tell us. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. As promised, we have Jaime on the line. I do want to conclude, though, before Jaime asks his next question, just to summarize what we have just considered. God recognizes what modern man rejects. Tolerating evil is being intolerant of good. Displaying mercy toward the wicked is merciless. Wickedness and wrongdoing, which rise above the level of individual guilt to societal liability, when we're talking now about politics and religion, they're the product of human schemes which must be condemned and contained. It's the most deadly pathogen in the world. Yahweh, speaking of the father of the Christian religion, Paul, calls him the plague of death. Such dogmas thrive in the minds and hearts of men and women, even in boys and girls. To eradicate them, the doctrines must be exposed, and their hosts must be rendered incapable of infecting others. Now, before we go to Jaime's question, keep in mind, it is one thing for the creator of all of life, the author of life, to make this decision. It is another thing for us individually. We have no sanction to do so. And so it is incumbent upon us to use words and evidence and reason to expose and condemn that which is malevolent. It is not incumbent upon us to take another life. So realize that just because God can and should do this, we are not empowered. We are not deputized to do it. There is no divine sanction to kill. Only for us to expose and condemn false teachings, false political and religious ideologies, so that others might live. That said, welcome back, Jaime.
Yeah, hi. Shalom. Okay, the next question I have has to do with speaking in tongues. Mm-hmm. Where are we on speaking in tongues? Actually, as a Christian,
purely completely pagan, completely and totally erroneous. The concept of speaking of tongues comes entirely from Paul. He talks about speaking in the tongues of angels, as if now you can have this Pentecostal movement where people jabber on pretending to speak in the tongues of angels. There are no tongues of angels. Angels are spiritual beings. They're actually malach. They're messengers. They're envoys. They don't communicate using the spoken word. And the language that Yahweh uses in heaven, there's only one language in heaven. There is one universal language of Yahweh, and he only uses one language because there's only one language that actually reflects his nature, and that's Hebrew. And so if you're not speaking Hebrew, then you're not speaking the language that is used to convey messages, not spoken messages, but still communicate via the messengers, the malach envoys. When you find the enactment of Shabuah, which is the promise of the Shabbat, this is in Jerusalem, 7 Sabbaths after the celebration of Bukurim, when Yahusha's spirit and Yahweh's spirit and Yahusha's soul were reunited. And there is this celebration of the set-apart spirit coming upon those who had availed themselves of the benefits of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. And they're now members of Yahweh's covenant family. And the spirit is now empowering them to speak the languages of humankind so that they can communicate the Torah's message. And it is specifically stated, all of the languages that they came to speak and the places that those people lived for those various languages are articulated. It's like 20 different countries that are articulated there. They were human dialects. And so Paul then takes it to a whole other level in his preaching, and Paul was a false prophet. Everything Paul said is untrue. And so if you're jabbering and thinking you're speaking in tongues and that that's somehow a divine good thing to do, you are sadly mistaken. So don't do it. Don't encourage it. Don't participate with anybody that does it. Run from it. Condemn it. Expose it. And the like.
Okay. The next question I have has to do with burial. In relation to my understanding is that cremation is from paganism. And that the burial should be like the traditional burial, so to speak.
Yeah. Yahweh provides no instructions whatsoever on the burial because it's irrelevant.
It's irrelevant? Okay.
It's irrelevant. Our bodies are meaningless. You know, that's, again, a legacy of Christianity where they believe in bodily resurrection. There is no bodily resurrection. Our bodies are absolutely meaningless. The only thing we should be concerned about is our souls. And our souls cannot be burned. They cannot be destroyed by the elements. And it does not make any difference if your body is consumed by the little buggers that are part of the decomposition. Or fire. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. Before we entertain Jaime's next question, I do want to have a bit of a confession here. I am not a source of answers. I know where to go to find the answer. I don't even like being referred to as a teacher because I'm a student. I know where to go to find sound instruction. Yahweh is the teacher. And Yahweh has the answers, and he has made his teaching and his answers available to us in his Torah, which means guidance and instruction. And so I am more than comfortable answering questions based upon what I have learned from Yahweh. But I want to be very clear here that that Yahweh is the one that we should go to for answers. I look at my role in this very much like if we were to listen to, for example, the speech that Assad's deputy gave in the United Nations. He spoke in Arabic. If you don't understand Arabic, everything he said would just be noise. But if you had a translator who was more than just a translator, this translator could not only convey the message in the language that you're comfortable with, like English, but could also provide the context so that you know who the parties were that he was talking about, provide a religious and political and geographic perspective, and then make connections between the various countries so that you understood what he was talking about because you were well informed. That's the role I see myself providing as it relates to the Hebrew words that comprise the Torah. I'm both a translator of those plus a commentator in the sense of helping provide a context for better understanding and to help the listener make the connections that facilitate comprehension. But that's really the extent of it. I'm not a prime source of any of this information, and I'm trying never to answer based upon my own opinions, but instead on what Yahweh has conveyed. With that said, Jaime, you have another question? You've started these up.
Yeah. I know that when we die, you know, we either enter into the reign of Yahweh, or we get extinguished, or we go to Sheol.
Yes.
Does that happen when we die, or does that come later on? Or is that your judgment, so to speak, right then?
Yeah, you brought up an extraordinarily important point, and for those who are new to the program, I'm going to need to provide a little perspective for that. And then you've now asked a question that I think I know the answer, but I cannot say for sure that I know the answer, so I'm going to be a bit equivocal. One of the things that's really wrong in Christianity and of course, Islam, is that Christians preach that souls either go to heaven or hell, and that you ought to be careful because if you don't get into heaven, you're going to go to hell. Well, a God who would say, love me, or I'm going to see to it that you're tortured in hell, would not be lovable. And so most agnostics and atheists who are agnostics and atheists are made that decision because they recognize the Christian position of you love me or you go to hell is sadistic. And so they don't want any part of such a God. Well, the fact is that in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, as you know, Jaime, God consistently presents the realization that the vast preponderance of souls simply cease to exist. For them, there is no punishment. There is no eternity of anguish. They were given mortal life, and they never came to know Yahweh, never came to understand his covenant, never chose to participate in it. So at the end of their mortal existence, they simply cease to exist. And their souls no longer exist. And then there are those who deliberately lead people away from God. Those would be who are active in religion and politics in particular. They might be active in the military, who have taken lives and therefore made it difficult for others to come to know Yahweh. There is a consequence of that and a punishment, and it's eternal anguish in Sheol. Now, Sheol, there are no fires in Sheol. There's no torture in Sheol. It is simply eternity apart from God. It's represented by a black hole, infinite in time and finite in other dimensions. Now, so your question regarding that, and then, of course, those who embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant spend eternity in Yahweh's presence, and we get to explore the universe for all time with him. So your question is, when is that determination made? And there appears to have been a time before Yahweh in the person of Yahusha. Yahusha is simply a corporeal, diminished manifestation of Yahweh, set apart from Yahweh into our world to fulfill his promises. Until Yahweh, through Yahusha, fulfilled and enabled the promises of Pesach, Matzah, Vekunim, and Shavuah, there is the possibility, in fact, the probability, that there was a temporary holding place where the souls of those who had died that were part of the covenant were able to experience a time which is called Abraham's bosom, in the bosom of the covenant, and that at that moment they were taken to heaven, but they were taken to heaven following the firstborn child, because that's what Bakuda means, is firstborn children, and the firstborn child of the covenant really has to be Yahusha. And so I think there was a delay there. That delay would have been meaningless in terms of those individuals, because they are now immortal. Now, in the case of the two groups that are going to be judged. Now, I think at this point now, to be absent of life here on Earth, if you remember the covenant family, is to be instantly engaged with Yahweh. Now, for those who die who do not know Yahweh, who are the victims of religion or politics, or those who are the perpetrators of religion and politics, there's going to be a judgment. God has to determine whether or not their soul is simply extinguished, which is a consequence, not a punishment, or they're going to do, as a result of what they have done, to be just, they're going to spend eternity with HaSatan and his demons in the abyss. And I suspect that all of that is going to take place in what's called the Great White Throne, the Great Light Judgment, when God's going to make that determination. But for those individuals that are awaiting that judgment, Jaime, I think they're in a state of suspended animation, if you will. And that, therefore, that even though this is going to happen 1,000 years from now when this judgment is going to take place, my sense is that they don't know it, that there is no anguish amongst those awaiting the determination of whether they're going to go into Sheol for all time or simply cease to exist, and that my guess is that God's not going to torment in any way, shape, or form those who were the victims of religion, that he is going to make very quick order of business and say, all right, you know, you were the victim. You were not a perpetrator, and therefore your soul is over. There is no memory of them, no existence for their soul. Their consciousness is simply gone. And those who are sent off to Sheol, I think those who are sent off to Sheol, I think there will be a fairly elaborate trial. I think there will be witnesses. I think we'll get to speak at those trials, I think they will be elaborate trials. Where the evidence is wrought against them, and they are held accountable for what they did.
Let me make a comment. Something that you tell me whether or not it lines up. You know, in the Psalms, I believe it's in the Psalms where it says that once we get to being in the reign of Yahuwah, that there will be no longer any tears for us at
correct.
All.
Right.
One of the things in prayer meditation that I was asking Yeshua was, well, you know, how can that be when, for example, if I have a brother that ended up not making it, you know, so I not be sad, et cetera, et cetera. Boy,
right.
And
right.
What I felt that my answer was given was that when we get there, that all memory, et cetera, of those individuals are completely blotted out from our memories.
Yeah.
And therefore, we don't remember them, that they exist in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
Therefore, there's nothing for us to cry about or be sad about.
Yeah.
Does that line up?
Yeah. It's not only that we won't have any memory of those who are not there, but we will also have no memory of the things that we did that were wrong. When God tells us that he has literally abolished all memory of every wrongdoing that we have ever done as a result of the covenant, of his plan, then if he doesn't know them, we aren't going to know them. And now, what you're leading towards, though, is the reason why there's going to be a new heaven and earth, the reason there's going to be a new universe, is directly related to what you're talking about here. And that is that at the end of the millennial Shabbat, after God has camped out here on earth, turned the earth into the Garden of Eden, and now we're in the process of beginning anew, the reason that there's going to be a new universe and that we're going to be witnesses to the new universe, because we're going to be able to maneuver in time. As light, we're going to be able to explore time itself. And if we were to be able to go back and look at the things that we did wrong or the hellish things that man did to his fellow man, there would be sorrow. And so this gives us the full reign to explore the universe, past, present, and future, without having any of that sorrow, which is the reason why God's going to create a new universe. But you're right. All pain, all memories of those things which were frustrating and painful will be obliterated. We start with a perfect and clean slate.
Okay, great. Well, that takes care of all the questions.
Okay. All right. Well, my my pleasure to try to answer them. Thank you, Jaime. All right, we're going to return to Yah's testimony. This is the next line that he shares with us about his covenant. You'll find it in Bereshit, the opening book of the Torah, in the beginning, Genesis 15:17. It reads, "It came to be that the sun had gone, and it was twilight. Then behold, a portable stove and a smoker, a fire pot, if you will, and an illuminated torch of fire, which beneficially passed through to enlighten for the purpose of promoting understanding between those separated parts." That's another very complex Hebrew sentence to convey, but there are many insights here that are worth our consideration, that benefit our understanding. In the last segment of Shattering Myths for today, we will analyze each word and come to understand what God is communicating to us. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. This line is also filled with insights in it, and it's important for us to recognize the scene that has been set. We've had Yahweh take Abraham to his home to expose Abraham to the actual inheritance of the covenant, which is that we are transformed and become like light, which ties into some of Jaime's questions about, whether or not it's appropriate to cremate a body or the body needs to be buried. The fact is that our bodies are meaningless. We transcend mortality by transcending being matter and become a spiritual being. And so God has shown Abraham that that's the inheritance of the covenant, that that is the way to become immortal. It's the way to become perfect. It's the way to become adopted. It's the way to become enriched and empowered by the benefits of the covenant. And then Abraham said, "Well, how can I know about that I'm going to receive these things for absolute certain?" And he, Yahweh, first told him that because he had come to trust and rely upon Yahweh, which means that he had to come to know Yahweh and understand what he was offering, which are preconditions to trusting and relying, that he was going to count his trust and reliance upon Yahweh's provisions, his provisions, as a means of viewing him as being righteous, of being perfect. Abram naturally said, "Okay, I get this, but I want to make sure that my response to you assures me of all of these benefits, because these benefits are terrific." And Yahweh began by establishing a festival feast. And he put that festival feast in the context of freeing his children, the heirs to the covenant, from the crucible of Egypt to him, from religious and political oppression. So now we know that God is specifically talking about the festival feast that comprised the first four mikre, which are invitations to meet with God, Passover, unleavened bread, firstborn children, and the promise of the Shabbat, of the Sabbath, because those were the defining moments of the means that Yahweh used to free his children from captivity in Egypt. Then what we find is that since this was to be an absolute certainty from Abraham's perspective, that Abraham was given the opportunity to choose Satan's way, to be deceived, to be corrupted, or to embrace Yahweh's solution. And so the sun set, and we find in reference to the sun the satanic entrance here. Yahweh tells us that a terrorizing and fearsome darkness represented by Satan descended on the place, and we find Abraham doing his best with his consciousness to reject the influence of Satan. So God is now saying that when it came to be that the sun, the influence here of Satan, had gone, and it was twilight, behold, he began the barbecue. So there was a smoker for roasting, for grilling the food that was being prepared for this wonderful celebration of life. God loves to camp out, and he loves festival feasts. It's what we're going to be doing in eternity. And then he also said that there was also the presence of an illuminated torch, a portable light source, because, you know, night can be a marvelous time when it's illuminated by the campfire, by a torch. God is telling us that his light provides guidance along the way. And that he said that that this torch beneficially passed through this whole process of this path that leads to him, which is delineated in these festival feasts, particularly the first four, that freed his children from the crucible of human oppression in Egypt, that where he himself passed at night before the children of Israel, leading them out as a pillar of fire. He is now symbolically referencing the concept of that same pillar of fire passing through, leading his children along this way. And he says that all of this is to enlighten us for the purpose of promoting understanding between those separated parts, between those who are separated. And understanding is everything. It's bien in Hebrew. Bien means to come to know by making connections between things. By being able to connect this illuminated fire, this torch, and the pillar of light that was Yahweh's presence at night with the children of Israel when he was leading them away from Mitzrayim, from Egypt, the crucible of human oppression, religious and political oppression. And that the stove, that this smoker, this fire pot, is symbolic of the way that God wants the food prepared during his festival feasts that provide our immortality, our perfection, our adoption, our enrichment and empowerment. That if we pull all of these things together, make the connections between them, then we will understand and no longer be separated.